Hello and welcome to the Internet Storm Center podcast, episode number 13. Sorry for the length of time it's taken to get podcasts out in between, but Johannes and I have been traveling a lot recently, and we just haven't had time to link up and sync together. But that being said, with me as always is Johannes Ulrich of SANS.
Hey there, Joel, and everybody listening.
Live via the Skype dial-in feature. So we had some problems with Skype today. So if Johannes sounds a little bit distant in the recording, now you know why. My name is Joel Essler of joelessler.net and of SourceFire. And like I said, this is episode number 13, and we're going to go ahead and get started and talk about a few topics. Just wanted to point out a couple things in relation to the Internet Storm Center itself, which is number one. Just wanted to point out that we now have mini podcasts. Johannes, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, essentially these mini micro podcasts, or actually stormcasts, how we call them now, it doesn't replace these more lengthy podcasts we still hope to put out regularly. But what those small podcasts do is they try to summarize every day of what happened that particular day. So they last about 5 to 10 minutes. It really depends on, you know, how much is happening and how much there is to talk about. We will have guest speakers for them occasionally, or somebody else will present a particular topic of interest, like we had this Monday, Jerry Rose, who was talking about the IPv6 tunnel provider. And just subscribe to them, you know, with iTunes, whatever. isc.sans.org/podcast.html. That's the URL where you'll find more information on how to subscribe to them. A couple of the recent episodes, you will also be able to listen there straight through your web browser. The lengthy podcast, like the regular podcast I'm doing with Joel here, will also be listed on that URL. So that's, again, isc.sans.org/podcast.html. If you already use iTunes, then just search for Stormcast in the podcast section, and it should come up there right away.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a little mini podcast. We'll, like Johannes said, we're going to continue to try and put these bigger podcasts out more regularly, but the problem is, like I was saying at the beginning, with our travel schedule and everything, we just haven't had a lot of time to get that out. And it's really unfortunate because we enjoy doing it, but we're all over the place, I'll tell you what. So anyway, with that, let's go ahead and begin talking about our topics that we have lined up for you today. I think today, number one, will be yesterday's BGP issue, Johannes.
Yeah, right. And with that, really, the question, do we need a new internet? You know, is the internet broken enough where we should just scrap it and start from scratch?
That's right. I believe John Markoff of the New York Times wrote a piece this weekend that was entitled, Do We Need a New Internet? So basically it was kind of like a philosophical standpoint on, basically is the internet worth saving, or, you know, is it too far down the path to reverse the cleanliness of the internet now? So I don't know. What do you think about that, Johannes?
I'm not sure if the problem is really as much technical versus human. Now, there are a couple fundamental flaws in the internet, if you want to say it this way. One of the problems that sort of came up yesterday was, of course, the entire routing infrastructure, with BGP really being a protocol that relies a lot on trust between all these different people that peer with each other. There is no real good, great central registry on who owns what IP address. You would think that, you know, who is, and so it's a way to do it. Truth be told, well, who is far from perfect in telling you who owns what IP address space. And, of course, with that, once you have a BGP session enabled or established and you have peers that propagate your BGP messages, you can advertise whatever IP address range you wish. And if your peers don't filter that correctly, it just propagates. And once it's down a couple hops, then people really have no idea whether or not these BGP announcements are real or not.
Right. So essentially, I think the whole premise of the article that came out on the New York Times, and I think the whole premise of the BGP thing that happened yesterday, is basically the security of the internet is we're relying on humans to not be stupid. We're relying on humans to not be human, right? So humans are essentially, fault prone, and computers are only going to do, and routers for that matter, in terms of BGP, are only going to do what you tell them to do. Okay, so everybody has to kind of grow up and learn to use the internet in a smart and in a secure way before, a lot of these problems go away. But I've said it for years, and I'll say it again here, is that no matter what we come up with to kind of counter the threats that are out there, there are always going to be something that counters us. So that being said, computers are just plain dummy systems. Yes, they're very smart and that kind of thing, but we haven't developed any type of artificial intelligence yet to prevent humans from being stupid and clicking on things they should not click on and advertising BGP routes that they should not advertise and things like that. But basically, the whole cusp of security on the internet is not only do we have to prevent the bad guys from doing things, but we have to prevent stupid people from doing stupid things. So that's generally
The jury is still a little bit out on what happened yesterday, whether it was malicious or not. The effect was malicious, that it took down a lot of routers.
Right.
But the actual intent, essentially what happened was that the way BGP works is it will prefer the shorter route. So what you can do sometimes if you have a short route that you really don't want to use or don't want to advertise because, for whatever reason, the particular peer that you're using is quite expensive or you more intend as a backup route. So what you do is you make it artificially longer. And the way you do that, the way you make a route artificially longer is that you keep inserting the same AS, the same network number over and over. So, typically the route would be, number 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, you now make that route artificially longer, so you just say 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 3, 4. And, if you do that 2 or 3 times, nothing bad happens. The problem here in this case yesterday was that I forgot to count exactly, but I did it 50 times. They added this particular network 50 times. So the overall BGP message became too large. And you had, in essence, sort of a buffer overflow. Again, it became worse because certain routers, instead of just filtering these routes and throwing them out, they actually crashed and the BGP session crashed. So they stopped routing when they saw these routes. And they stopped routing to globally, overall, not just for that particular route, which was the problem here. I think it's a mistake. We have seen malicious bad routes being advertised by spammers. So what a spammer can do is the spammer takes a chunk of IP address space that's either not assigned or assigned to somebody else and just borrows it. And now, of course, they can send their spam. After they're done sending their spam, they will release that IP address space, and now all the abuse messages and whatever go back to the actual owner of the IP address space, if there is an actual owner. That's kind of what you're facing there. I don't know, Joe, is there any great way to defend yourself against that stuff?
Not really. I mean, the way that the internet works is it's all about, cooperation, right? So especially with BGP routes, it's kind of like, you tell other routers where your network is and that kind of thing, and the other network kind of has to accept and kind of cooperate with you. And when you have a guy or you have an ISP, in this case it was an ISP in Czechoslovakia, that advertised an extremely large BGP, an extremely large session yesterday, or an extremely large path yesterday. Basically it just grinds to a halt. So I don't know if there's really anything you can kind of do to defend against it. I mean, you know, filter out really long PGPs.
Yeah. There are not that many people that actually, you know, configure BGP routes and monitor BGP traffic. Most of the time, your IDS really will never really see any BGP in the first place. I guess there are a couple of sort of free and commercial services I've seen out there, like Ripe, for example, run something that you can use to alert you if somebody's trying to hijack your IP address space. So essentially what you do is you monitor the internet, and they have a few routers set up that monitor for unauthorized BGP announcements for your IP address space. So at least you get an alert and say, hey, somebody's trying to advertise your IP address space. But then really the solution to that, once that happens, it's fairly cumbersome, kind of like shutting down an old phishing site. So you have to tell people somebody is trying to hijack your IP address space. Now you have to somehow prove that it is actually your IP address space, and then get people to filter out these bad announcements. And it's sort of a one-off solution that's really quite labor-intensive and difficult to do.
Right. Yeah. Well, basically, you know, most of the routers by the major ISPs were fine. You know, they just passed it on or whatever. But
correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the routers that are downstream, you know, maybe they weren't maintained. Or whatever, you know, they view the update as I'm reading from a website right here. It's actually a really good. We actually have a really good blog post about the BGP sesh thing that happened yesterday at isc.sans.org. I think it's let me look at the diary number. I'll give you the exact number, but it's number 5872. So if you go there and look for 5872, but there's a post there that says, I just want to read basically from this because they explain it really well, and I don't want to try and paraphrase them. But basically it says, the routers that weren't well-maintained or were running buggy software, these routers viewed the update as malformed and so tore down their session with whomever sent them the update. So, right, it's not a big deal. But in other words, the two routers that were happily exchanging traffic with each other just moments before suddenly stopped all communication. Traffic was lost, alternative paths were explored, and, you know, routers recovered and reestablished contact. Well, that's not the big deal. You know, one router, two router, that's not a big deal. But you multiply that by thousands of routers, and you begin to have a huge problem. So I encourage you to take a look at that blog post that we put on the Internet Storm Center today and read all about it. It's really good information.
Is it from Renesis?
Yes, yes.
They run one of those services that monitors BGP routing. And I think one of the themes that stuff keeps coming back is that the Internet core is actually, you know, very robust, well-maintained, and you have people really in charge of the Internet core routers that know what they're doing. You know, question asked, they patch the systems, they know how to configure them right, they set up all the filtering. The problem is a lot of these sort of edge systems, smaller companies, smaller ISPs that try to do their own routing but don't really know what they're doing. Some guy years ago set up a BGP router, and now there's nobody really around anymore to patch it or fix it. They quite frankly don't really have the manpower to really spend the time to understand how that BGP router really works. So that's a very common issue, not just with BGP, but lots of other networking problems.
Yeah, and that happens with everything.
Comes back to the idea that, to some extent, do we need a new internet? Do we really want an internet where a small mom-and-pop ISP can't connect to? Part of the success of the internet is that you are able to connect cheaply. Now, whether or not that's a good idea and whether or not you'll be able to connect reliably at the low cost that you're putting into that connection, that's another question. But to some extent, all those low-cost, you know, duct-taped-together connections really make the internet work to some extent. That gives it a critical mass for people to actually use it for all the good stuff, you know, that's being used these days.
Right. That's great. BGP is wonderful. Causes more problems, but hey, it works. So we can't complain too much.
It worked.
That's right. So moving on from BGP. BGP is great, but let's move on to the web honeypot that we have going up.
Right, because BGP is not the only thing that's broken. The web is broken.
PHP is broken too.
PHP and BGP, it's all difficult actually to keep all these acronyms apart. For a while now, we experimented with this web honeypot at DeepShield. And DeepShield really was based on the premise that once you put out a lot of sensors across the internet, you will get an accurate picture of what's going on in terms of attack traffic. Now, DeepShield, of course, was quite simple. All we had was firewall logs, and firewall logs are easy to collect. They're not really all that verbose. There's no real privacy concern with firewall logs because really all you capture are connections that got never established. So what I was working on was trying to move that basic premise to web logs, because what we really see happening now is that a lot of the attacks come over port 80. So, you have a web server running there, then your firewall is not going to tell you anything because port 80 is permitted. And if you do not have a web server, then all connections to port 80 are intercepted and you don't really know what's happening. On the other hand, just collecting web logs themselves from a live web server is tricky because now you have actual content and then you have privacy concerns. What, for example, if an administrator configures their web server badly and now things like social security numbers are logged on the URL or in the weblog credit card numbers and such? I don't really want to be the custodian of that kind of data. So what we came up with was a honeypot, and that honeypot is pretty easy to set up. All you need is a web server, can be Apache or IIS, but right now it's better tested with Apache, that runs PGP. And now what the honeypot script does is it essentially reports the full request back to our database. Now, you do want to set it up as a honeypot, so that should be its own web server, at least its own virtual host on an Apache web server. It does nothing but collect this kind of data. Now, otherwise, again, you would end up reporting like confidential data to us in particular, since now we capture the complete request. So this weekend, we released the first alpha release of the software. It's a little PHP script. It's not really all that hard. You can look at it. You can see that it doesn't really do anything malicious or anything that it doesn't tell you it will do. Once a request hits that PHP script, it will look at the request, look at the URL, and then it will feed back the template, which is just a static HTML page, that matches most closely the particular request. So if somebody's looking for a URL, something like /phpbb, it will send something back that looks like PHP bulletin board. If somebody is looking for a request that has like no tricks box in it, it will send back something that looks like a tricks box, the voice over IP admin interface. And that's sort of how it fools or makes it look like there are all these vulnerable applications installed on this one web server. It's working quite well. The intent really is not to be a perfect full interaction honeypot, but to be good enough to capture all of these thousands of automated probes. So that's really the intent, to capture automated probes. And so far, just from the few examples we have set up, the few test cases we have set up, it works quite well. And now with this alpha release, we have some code for you that you can use yourself and you can play with and give us feedback on. So check it out. Look at the current diary archive. It's, do you have it in front of you, Joel?
Yeah.
The diary ID number.
It's 5881.
Yeah, it's written by Jason Lam, so if you look for that name, it should still show up in at the bottom of the index page in the little diary archive summary from the last couple of days.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to install. You know, all you need is one PHP file that's parsing these requests. Then there's a bunch of templates that comes with it. You can add your own templates if you would like to. And then you have to configure Apache to redirect all requests to that index.php. And the line, the configuration on how to do that comes with the configuration script. There's a second PHP script that helps you configure the honeypot for your system. So at least for me, it works great. But what I really need now is you to install it and give us feedback and send us your logs.
Right. Speaking of requesting logs, I put out a request for logs the other day. I think last week sometime, and I said, yeah, basically we receive, you know, millions and millions of lines of logs a day for DShield, and it's great. But we'd like some more, basically. what we're trying to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. We receive anywhere between about 10, depending on the day, depending on what's going on the internet, we receive anywhere between about 10 and about 25 million. Is that accurate, Johannes?
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, about 10 to 25 million lines of firewall logs a day. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to up that by 50% or up by 100%. You know, I'd like to see that go way up. And while we definitely love things like cable modems, so for home users and things like that, we definitely like things like cable modems, and we like to have things like, I don't know what else, small businesses, home users, that type of thing, because the reason for that is they cover more IP address space. If you think about it, right, if we have 1,000, if we have 1,000 submitters, each with their own individual IP address, each submitting their firewall logs into DShield, or you have one small business with one, with one class C assigned to them, or even smaller than that, you know, maybe four or five IPs assigned to them, we're going to see way more logs with the 1,000 than we would with the four or five IPs. So what I'm saying is that we would like not only more users for the individual wide IP address space for the cable users and things like that, but we'd also like to have mass amount of logs for things like, if you can get permission. Don't do it without permission, okay? But if you work for a corporation that's interested in participating with DShield, explain DShield to them, most likely they might already know about it, that kind of thing. We would like to have, even if you want to obfuscate your logs, and so we can't see your IP addresses at all, that's totally fine. But we would like to have more firewall logs. We're definitely interested in where the traffic's going, what it's doing, and amounts and increases and things like that. We have a lot of algorithms within the database and within our programs to automatically look at all the data that's coming into DShield and draw some really pretty graphs. But we would like to have more information. Anything you want to say on that one, Johannes?
No, I think you said it pretty well. But really what it's about is for us also to get a good variety of logs. So no dial-up modem, no cable modem is small enough, really. What we really keep fighting with is we lose subscribers, we get subscribers, we have to get as many subscribers as we use, then people reconfigure their firewalls. We cannot support all firewalls, so sometimes they change firewall out. And now a long-time submitter is switching to a new firewall, the new firewall is no longer supported by us. And we need to make up for sort of that subscriber churn somewhat with our data to really maintain the data quality. So what is up to me really is not as much, whether we get 10, 20, or 30 million lines of logs each day, but how many distinct different subscribers do we have and how many different geographic regions and industries and such we cover to really get a good picture of what's going on out there.
Right, yeah. We have We have thousands of subscribers that submit logs to us, and you know, millions and millions of lines of logs. But basically, we're saying, "Hey, we want more." That's basically what we're saying. So,
yeah.
So, if you want to participate with us, I did put out that call. I think last week I did that. Let me see if I can find the article number here right quick. But you can go to dshield.org and look up, you know, how to submit. Basically, if you go to dshield.org/how-to.html.
How-to.html, yeah. That's the URL.
You can find out how to submit. And we even accept things like snort logs, you know, IDS logs, things like that. So if you can basically, if you can make them fit into the DShield format, we will take them. The diary number is 5857. So take a look at that. Submit your logs. We need some good stuff. So, but actually, by the way, Johannes, while we're talking about Snort, just want to talk about an update to Snort. I've blogged about it on my website at joelessler.net. But it's also on snort.org. But we have a new version of Snort that is currently in, I think it's in beta. I don't know if we've made a release candidate out of it yet. Let me take a look. But basically, right now we have a new version of Snort that's coming out. It's in release candidate stage one. Yep. It's version 2.8.4. So, if you look at the current version, which is 2.8.3.2, this is 2.8.4. So it's the next minor revision. But basically, 2.8.4 is going to have a preprocessor in it that is called the DCE RPC2 preprocessor. Okay. Now, let me give you a little bit of history. The NetBIOS.rules, if you're familiar with Snort, you're familiar with the NetBIOS.rules rule category. Basically, the NetBIOS rules category has thousands, probably I think it's greater than 4,000 rules in it. And the majority of these rules are for state tracking. So because the way NetBIOS interacts and the way that various exploits can take place over NetBIOS. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that NetBIOS exploits can take place. Our vulnerability research team at SourceFire has went and figured out all these different ways of exploiting things through NetBIOS, and we've written rules to cover all of those different ways. So what happens is that we've written thousands and thousands of rules to do all the state tracking. Well, basically, those thousands and thousands of rules are becoming too cumbersome to maintain. They're way too hard to read, and they're becoming I wouldn't say they're too slow on the engine, but we want to make sure that we always keep ahead of the curve, and we want to make sure that our engine, that Snort, the IDS, is as fast as possible. So we're coming out with this new preprocessor. What it does is it does all that state tracking for us. Now, it does. 2.8.4 does a bunch of things. Like, for instance, it supports IPv6 in the fragmentation and application preprocessors and things like that. But the major thing is that DCE RPC2 preprocessor. Now, you might ask, what impact does that have for me as the user? Well, if you are using anything less... Now, pay attention when I say this. If you are using anything less than 2.8.4 and you do not upgrade to 2.8.4, you will no longer be eligible to use the NetBIOS.rules category. The reason for that is because we are writing the preprocessor to use particular keywords that we're going to incorporate into the NetBIOS.rules individual rules. So those rules will call keywords out of the preprocessor. So basically what we're saying is we can't maintain two versions of the rule set post 2.8.4. So as we always preach at Snort, you know, keep your version of Snort on the latest release. Sometimes, like Debian packages and the Gentoo and all those, you know, the RPMs and things like that, they don't keep their individual builds updated, or like the ports for FreeBSD and things like that. They don't keep the individual builds updated. Well, we always recommend that you download the source code from snort.org and you build from scratch. Now, the reason for that is so that you have the latest and greatest version of Snort, so that you can run the latest version of the rules, so that you have the most up-to-date and enhanced detection capability. So the reason for that DCE RPC2 preprocessor is a bunch of things, but the big key for it is if you're not using 2.8.4, you will not be able to use the NetBIOS rules anymore, or at least the most updated ones. So I encourage anybody that's running less than 2.8.4 to go ahead and take a look at the beta, the release candidate for 2.8.4. We need beta testers for it. So if you go to snort.org/DL for download, you can check that out and take a look at and beta the software for us. We need testers. And, of course, we have a netbios.rules updated category out that takes that incorporates the features of the new preprocessor. But we definitely need feedback about that rule set, just because we need, once we go to 2.8.4, you won't be able to use the older rule set anymore. So it's very important. So I just wanted to cover that right quick. But other than that, that's all my Snort news for the day. let me see. What else? What else do we have beyond that? We have, of course, we talked about the article about, do we need a new internet? I don't know. Personally, I don't think we need a new internet. We just need to make the internet smarter, I think. What do you think about that, Johannes?
Yeah, like, I think always it's, if you can't explain it to a user, or if you can't explain it to a user, you can also write a shell script to do it. I'd rather have things retrofitted to the internet as we use it now, then first of all, you know, put too much of a burden to the user or start over from scratch. Chances are when we do it over from scratch, it will look better initially, but we really will just either make, in the best case, make a lot of new mistakes. Worst case, we do a lot of old mistakes.
Right. Yeah, I don't think if we build a new internet, like you said, it's not going to get any better. You know, it's basically they're going to find different ways around the security that we build in. And plus, I don't think, even if we tried to build a new internet, I don't think it would be possible. There's too many people, there's billions of users on the internet that's there now. I don't think we could, I don't think we could build a new one. Just, I don't know.
Yeah, any change like that, I think, has to be gradual and sort of more evolutional. So what will happen eventually is that the current internet, well, ultimately it will be replaced, but it will be replaced gradually and in a somewhat backward compatible way. Isn't really that much broken with the internet, and there are some issues that can already be fixed. I always hate the notion of, you know, setting up a secure internet. Like, there's always this idea going around, let's set up a secure internet only for banks. That sounds like a great idea. I think start thinking about, why do banks use the internet? Well, one reason they use the internet is because they like to communicate with their customers. As soon as you would like to use this new secure internet to communicate with your customers, well, you get non-banks customers again into that internet, and it will be untrusted and broken or unsecure as it is now. What it really comes down to is to make the internet secure enough so it's worthwhile keeping, and whatever effort and money and time you save using the internet is justified. And, well, let's face it, you know, we will always have crime, we will always have parts of the internet are broken, but we just have to keep those parts small enough where they don't overwhelm the useful part of it.
That's right. There's always going to be worms and Trojans and viruses. There has been since the beginning of the internet, with things like, you know, the Morris worm. But it's just the way it is. I just think we have to do the best we can to kind of secure you know, secure their way around it. I mean, you even look at some government networks. You know, the United States military has its own version of the internet. You know, several layers of it, and even that's vulnerable. So, I mean, it's going to, you know, there's always going to be ways around it. So I just think we have to do the best we can and kind of, you know, basically when the internet was stood up, security wasn't thought of, and it wasn't thought of for 20 years. Now all of a sudden security is very, very important, and now we have to kind of think backwards to kind of counter the threats and kind of think forwards to kind of how are we going to preempt the threats in the future and that kind of thing. So I don't think we need a new internet. I think we just need to secure that one, the one that we have, better. That's all.
By the way, what time is it?
It is 2:50.
Which time server did you use?
I am using time.apple.com. Let me tell you which one I'm not using.
The problem is that the other day or this weekend, it's just sort of an interesting thing on how sometimes I guess we start making our own news here, which is one reader wrote in, well, time.microsoft.com is down. The panel on duty, I think it was Deb Taylor who was on duty, checked it, and yeah, it was down. However, there was a little trick here. Time.microsoft.com is not the time server that is used at all by Microsoft.
That's right.
Time.windows.com.
That's right.
And now Katie wrote up that diary, time.microsoft.com is down. And all of a sudden, lots of other people reported in, yeah, it's down for me too. And so what happened is a little bit of self-fulfilling prophecy, self-fulfilling news story, where we started mentioning that time.microsoft.com name, and turns out others used that same wrong setting for their time server. The right setting for the Windows time server is time.windows.com, not time.microsoft.com. I hope I didn't just mix up those two.
Time.windows.com? It's time.windows.com.
Time.windows.com is the right one, yes.
Right, and what something that people don't know is that time.windows.com is actually a member of the ntp.org pool, the pool.ntp.org.
So, oh, nice.
Yep, so something a lot of people don't know is that actually the Windows.com is actually a member of the NTP tool. So if you don't like getting your time from Microsoft, whatever, just get your time from time.nist.gov or whatever. But
yeah. I'm not sure if you should use time.nist.gov because that's a little bit more limited resource. Probably the best advice if you don't want the Microsoft one is the NTP pool. Or was it ntp.pool.org or
pool.ntp.org, yeah.
Yeah, pool.ntp.org. That particular host name resolves to a whole bunch of time servers that are donated. A little trick that always works great for me is a lot of routers have actually NTP servers built in because some of these SONET routers also need a good time to keep that session synchronized. So what you can try and do is try to one hop outside of your network and see if that router has an NTP server built in that you can use. That usually works quite well. They're well synchronized, and it's only one hop away from you, so chances of it going down are fairly slim. Just a little trick if you don't like to run your own time server or if you don't like to rely on this cloud of NTP servers.
Right. If you go to ntp.org, there's a link on there that says, let me see exactly what it says. I just clicked through. It says public time server lists. So there is a huge list of Stratum 1 and Stratum 2 and then the pool time servers for NTP. And you are welcome to grab any one of those if you don't like, you know, there's north-america.pool.ntp.org, things like that. And my phone's ringing. Isn't that great? So, yeah, if you grab one of those, or you can grab, you know, the NIST.gov or whatever. You know, my Apple computers here come with time.apple.com. So, yeah, it's basically what our point is that it's not time.microsoft.com. It's time.windows.com. So,
correct.
Maybe sometime in the future they'll submit a CNAME record to kind of point it over there. But that remains.
Who knows? So yeah. By popular demand, I guess.
Yeah, popular demand by accident. Yeah. So it would make sense for time.microsoft.com, but we'll see. Yeah. I guess. So all right. Well, that's the NTP time issue that we were talking about. I think our last topic we wanted to cover just right quick, even though it's kind of impossible to cover just right quick, is the Conficker worm. Do you want to talk about that one, Johannes?
A little bit. Yeah, it's one of those beasts that doesn't quite go away. Now, there are a couple issues with that. First of all, that worm was just amazingly successful in infecting millions of people. The numbers you have seen in the press are 1 million, 10 million or so. They're actually real numbers. Like, I talked to some of the people that came up with these numbers, and they do have sound ways to come up with these amounts. They're not just marketing ploys people put up there. But those are real pretty good estimates of how big Conficker down add up is.
Yeah.
A big part of that worm was actually, again, social engineering, where it just made it very easy to install and very hard to remove. That's really sort of the theme with that particular worm.
Right. Yeah, the Conficker worm was actually pretty smart. I know some people that, basically they've reverse engineered the DNS algorithm and that kind of thing. And it does a lot of things. I mean, one thing you can do is, if you live in the Ukraine and you have a Ukrainian keyboard, you're clear. It doesn't infect people with the
Ukrainian. Yeah, it doesn't want to attack the Ukraine, which, yeah, it doesn't, I guess, a little bit about what it's about. But,
it kind of tells you where it was written, too. So,
yeah.
So it does a lot of things, and I really don't want to go over everything that it does because, like I said, it does just so many things, but... and a lot of it's encrypted. It's really impressive. But so if you go to the article that we point to read all about it is an article that a SRI International wrote, the Computer Science Laboratory, SRI International wrote. And for those of you that have a pen, I'll give you the address. It's MTC. So Mike Tango Charlie, so mtc.sri.com /Conficker. So mtc.sri.com/Conficker. Real simple URL there. And if you go to our website, we have it on there as well. But take a look at the Conficker worm write-up. It's actually very smart and intelligent. And the problem with it is that it's so random that it's hard to catch. Well, actually, what we found out at Snort is we figured out that it uses two of the exploits that it uses are one of the exploits it uses is 0867, actually. So that's actually really detectable using an IDS. And I think one of the other ones it uses, I don't remember exactly the Microsoft vulnerabilities it uses, but 0867 is one of them. I have to look up what the other one is. Do you know that off the top of your head, Johannes, what the other one was? Did I lose Johannes? I think I did. So,
sorry, I'm still here.
Oh, that's okay.
I just had it quickly set on mute today.
Oh, that's fine.
No, I don't know the other vulnerability it uses.
I just pulled it
that
out.
One.
Yeah, so... 08067 and 06040. So those two vulnerabilities are two of the vulnerabilities that Conficker actually uses to spread. And So if you're using things like Snort or whatever, you can detect the Conficker worm spreading. So.
Okay, cool. Yeah. The other thing, of course, it does spread over USB and file shares.
Oh, yeah. It was like the Nimda worm from, 2003 era. It spread in much the same way.
Yeah.
So, but I encourage you to go take a look at that article from SRI. It's a great article about the Conficker worm. So go take a look at that and check it out. And it seems
like... Yeah, Boyan also published a couple diaries.
Oh, yeah.
There's about, some of the aspects of it that were reverse engineered. And one of the interesting thing about these diaries also is show you all the debug screenshots and how you figured out these different features.
Oh, yeah, they're very technical, and I actually really appreciate our handlers doing that kind of technical analysis and putting it up there because that's a resource. It's very good. I'm just reading the statistics about the Conficker worm, and actually something that was very interesting that I found, the most infected – any guess of what the most infected country was?
U.S.?
Nope. That's what I was thinking too, but no, it's China actually.
More edge systems, I guess.
Yeah, China. It's actually U.S. isn't even in like the top 10. China, Brazil, and Russia were the top three. I thought that's kind of interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
So I guess maybe United States is a little bit more proactive about their patching.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's pretty much it. What do you think, Johannes? Is that all we have for today?
I think it's for today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's wrap it up. And we want to thank you guys for listening. As always, be sure and visit the Internet Storm Center at isc.sans.org. And in order to contact us, there's a link at the top that says contact. So you can click on that and submit some feedback and that kind of thing. And that's pretty much it.
Okay, well, thanks, Joel, and thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yep, thanks, everybody. And like I said, we'll try and get these out more often as time permits. But, try and bear with us while we're working through schedules and everything. And in the meantime, enjoy our mini-podcasts. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks.